Счастье не жалко паян.
And this is Douglas Spotted Eagle, Sunrise Prayer. And we heard from Andrew Harvey. That was an archival interview, but he's still very active, and you can find out more at andrewharvey.net. You're welcome to join me for meditation and Qigong on Saturday in Prospect Park. We're meeting at the Grand Army Plaza Main Library at noon. And there's another meditation at Summer Stage, put together by another group, actually, at 5 p.m. And it's called The Big Quiet. So you can do a lot to engage in your own self-healing as we work together to transform our world. And you've been listening to Heart of Mind over at WBAI, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program, mostly, of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, speaking of archival interviews, an interview with Susanna Clark, author of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Stay tuned.
a hell of a platform for getting the in person's move.
Let's try that again, shall we?
In person's movie.
Okay, Dan, hold on. We'll get you started here. When they call this movie you're reviewing Jurassic World, I think they were talking about this studio.
In person's movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Jurassic World is a missed opportunity. Over $500 million in worldwide box office, the makers had a hell of a platform for getting their point across, and they don't quite stick it. The big gag, if you can call it that, of Jurassic World is that sometime in the near future, the public has become so jaded with revivified dinosaurs that the vast corporation running the titular theme park to continually come up with bigger, louder, more impressive creatures to lure the rubes back in. You don't have to be Andre Bazin to pick up the metaphor here. You do maybe need to be something of a mind reader to figure out if director Colin Trevorrow is directing this critique at his own corporate masters who initiated this pointless sequel, or to the perceived insistence of the general public for bigger, louder, etc., etc. Which, by the way, I think is bourgeois. People want to be entertained. It's up to the filmmaker to determine if he or she is going to do it in a way that intrigues and challenges, or that just cynically turns up the CG to 11 and lets it flood over the audience's eyeballs without triggering anything beyond an adrenal response. Since Trevorrow's previous film, the indie release Safety Not Guaranteed, played like something scientifically calculated to include all the elements of a standard, quirky independent film, I'm not quick to dismiss the latter as his goal. Whatever the intent, it does rob Jurassic World of the awe and wonder that made the original Jurassic Park so memorable. There's no big moment that allows you to just revel in the notion of prehistoric life once again walking the earth. Much like the jaded tourists crowding the theme park's streets, the film takes it all in stride, nowhere more galling than when John Williams' magnificent Jurassic Park theme is used for a flyover of the park's shopping strip, putting the marvelous notion of living, breathing dinosaurs on equal footing with a Margaritaville. Some of the sequences do have a fresh kick to them, a tense sequence where a couple of kids are attacked in a motorized hamster ball by the film's big bad, the Indominus Rex, or a moment when Chris Pratt goes on a motorcycle run with his beloved pet velociraptors. But when the finale is essentially a tripling down of the original film's ending, you're once again left wondering if Trevorrow sees the irony of snarking at overloaded summer fare while indulging in its excesses, or is just bending to commercial demands. There are many moments in Jurassic World that seem to ape the beats of Jurassic Park in service of critique, but Trevorrow has nowhere near the finesse of Spielberg, so if they are meant to advance the subtext, they fall flat. If they're just supposed to be thrills, they're soulless, hollow thrills. Where Trevorrow does succeed in following Spielberg's lead is in Jurassic World's somewhat retrograde attitude towards gender. When I first heard of Joss Whedon's criticism of the film for its cliche presentation of Bryce Dallas Howard's pants-suited businesswoman, I took it with a grain of salt, seeing as his assessment appeared to be based on exactly one scene from the film. But no, it's just as lazy and primitive as Whedon warned, and by the way, not too far removed from the same type of stock characterization that failed to engage me in Safety Not Guaranteed. As for Chris Pratt, whose character Owen seems to have been hired at the park to fill a job category called all-purpose action hero, his good-natured lunk persona only goes so far. Then you need someone like James Gunn to make the character really snap. There was never a need for a third Jurassic Park sequel. I suppose I should credit Colin Trevorrow for trying to get a pertinent idea across, but by either intent or accident, that point gets lost while trying to fulfill the perceived demands of the summer market. As underwhelmed as I was by Mad Max Fury Road, and I admit I'm in the minority there, I was still able to appreciate its audacity and ingenuity. Jurassic World fails in the very elements it needed to get its message across. It's one of a long line of films that, intending to criticize a thing, becomes the thing itself. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website. So if you want to check out what you missed, please go to MightyMoviePodcast.com.
Thank you, Dan. And, you know, I usually don't do reviews myself. Let's see, am I on? I'm never sure about this place. We did an entire program last week, and basically the transmitter and internet feed went off, and I owe such a deep apology to Lev Rosen, who went so far out of his way to be here, and I didn't make a local air check of the program. Usually I go home, get the air check from the WBAI archive, but the WBAI archive bleeped out at like 20 minutes into the show before his reading. Although different people said they heard it end at different times, so who knows? But we are going to present a program that I did air check this morning with Susanna Clark. But first, I wanted to do a review of something that I just watched tonight. I am on mailing lists, not for the big tentpole movies like Dan Persons gets, but I'm on the mailing list for a lot of the indie films, a lot of the smaller films, and I might even be bringing somebody in to do some of those lesser known and funded films at some point. But here's one from me that I saw a point from a PR person saying, you can get a streaming link. Well, cool. That means all I have to do is sit at home, turn on the computer, send the computer image and sound to the TV set, and watch the movie. And so I did. And it was Julie Taymor's version of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I was going to be very skeptical about it because there is always so much controversy over anything Julie Taymor does. And let me get the bad news out of the way first. At the beginning of the movie, it's a movie of a play. It's not a movie. It's a movie of a play. I think it's marketed as a Fathom event, one that people go primarily to movie theaters to see on a big screen. The sound begins awful. There's a lot of phasing noise, out of phase. Obviously, something was wrong with the microphones. It eventually gets much better, and you stop noticing. But at the very beginning, it's quite distracting. And, oh, yes, it's Shakespeare. Tain't normal American English. So one wants to pay attention, even when it's the dream, and you know it so well by heart. Number two, I didn't appreciate some of the movie jiggly camera work that was done. The rest, ooh, motorcycles on Atlantic Avenue, you hear that? The rest of my comments are, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was excellent. I didn't even know I was going to watch it all the way through before coming here, but I couldn't stop watching. It was lovely. It was slightly abridged, especially in the Pyramus and Thisbe part, but the whole play is there, and the Shakespeare comes through, and it comes through so well. And it's a fabulous interpretation using puppetry when it's Julie Taymor. It's always puppetry, big flowing sheets. A Oberon who is all ebony in skin tone and costume, and a Titania who is so white in costume and in, you know, pale. An amazing double jointed Puck who brings something new to the role. Music that goes from viol to klezmer, but amazing sets. Also, by the way, a very sensual production. This is not the, you know, when I first saw Midsummer Night's Dream, I saw it in a mobile version of Shakespeare in the Park that was quite kid-friendly. This is not. It's not outrageously adult, but it's not for the kiddies. This is for sophisticated people who are going to get Shakespeare's double entendres, which come through beautifully, the puns, the iambic pentameter, the verse bent, still totally understandable. A brilliant Bottom of the Weaver, who's, you know, a guy from New York. This performance was done in Brooklyn, by the way. And that's all. So let me say that A Midsummer Night's Dream, the movie of Julie Taymor's production, is in fact surprisingly well worth going to see. Okay, now that fits in so well with our theme for tonight's program, because we're discussing fairy. Not fairyland, fairy, F-A-E-R-I-E. I hope that you heard that in the way I said it. And that is the world, Spenser's fairy, that Midsummer Night's Dream is largely set. And that is certainly part of the world of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, a book that I loved since the first time I read it. And the author of that book, Susanna Clarke, came to WBAI about 10 years ago when the novel came out. And then arts director Janet Coleman and I interviewed her. She also did a reading for us at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which is on hiatus, by the way, until September. And she was wonderful. She's not directly involved with the television production that is now showing on BBC America. And by the way, you can actually pick it up from YouTube, at least episode one. After that, I think it's on Amazon as well and BBC America on demand, etc. But it's in England, it's up to episode five. Episode five is already played, and it's on Sunday nights. Here in the U.S., it's on, unsurprisingly, in what was the Doctor Who time slot. Again, this is not for the kiddies. There are some idiots who refer to it as being Harry Potter-like. Well, you know, it's not in any way, shape, or form. It takes more of its DNA from Jane Austen than it does from J.K. Rowling. But there, fairies are not nice, okay? Let's get that straight. They have their own agendas. They create changelings. They do all kinds of stuff. Let me stop talking. Let's listen to the absolutely wonderful and remarkable Susanna Clarke from about 10 years ago when the novel first came out. And here we are.
Susanna Clarke's new novel, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, has created such a gigantic literary sensation. And because Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is a book about magic, magic for adults, a compendium of really lots of magic, lots of sorcery, and lots of literary influence from the world of fantasy and magic. I am joined also by our resident expert on magic and science fiction, Mr. Jim Freund of Hour of the Wolf. And welcome, Jim, to ask about the magical properties of the book. I, myself, would like to ask a little bit about your literary antecedents here. This is a big 700-page-plus novel, and it explores two magicians, and it explores Merry England in circa 1805, around the time of the Napoleonic Wars. And I want to know what bees were in your bonnet. What were you reading, and what did you digest before you embarked on this 10-year writing project?
The books that I read as a child, the books that I loved best, were books of magic. I think C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia formed my idea almost of what a really compelling book ought to be, a book you could lose yourself in. And as an adolescent, I loved things like Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea Trilogy, T.H. White, and also Alan Garner, who writes about magic and England. But the influences which are most apparent, I think, on the surface of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell are not fantasy. They're Jane Austen and Charles Dickens. And I was very conscious that I wanted to draw upon their work while I was writing Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. I looked particularly to Jane Austen for dialogue, the way people spoke, for that wonderful ironic sense of humor that she has, and also for her very detailed descriptions of the social behavior and how people lived and thought and their moral compasses in the Regency period. So I think a lot of the fantasy influences are there, but they're kind of buried a bit deeper, whereas I think the Jane Austen and Charles Dickens are more apparent for all to see.
You've mentioned also that among your science fiction influences were Buffy and the Vampire Slayer. So that was that. In what way does that come to affect Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell?
I'm not entirely sure. I loved Buffy largely for its character-driven plot. I mean, the plots sometimes were a little bit on the silly side. Sometimes they were a little bit predictable, but they were good fun. But the real drama at the heart of Buffy is the dialogue and the way everything comes out of the characters. And I guess that is an influence here, because I hope that this book is largely about the people, and that the adventure unfolds because of the shortcomings and the vices and the virtues of the characters, rather than being imposed by the magic from the outside.
And these characters, let's talk a little bit about them, as they're both magicians immersed in the study of magic and then bringing magic to England and to save England in the time of Napoleon. And do you identify with either of these magicians? Are you one of them? Or is the author connected more to one than the other?
I think I'm more connected in some ways. I'm a bit ashamed to say it, to Mr. Norrell. Norrell is a very fussy, pedantic, shy little man. I don't think that's me. But he is all about books. He has a huge library, which he's amassed, and he's kind of bought up every book of magic in England, and he's very loath to show them to anybody else. Also, that's not really me. But the bit which is me is that he really loves being on his own. He loves studying. He loves writing and reading in a room full of books. And I think most writers can relate to that to some extent.
And in my casting of the movie, by the way, he would be played by Anthony Stewart Head, speaking of
Buffy. Oh, really?
Yeah. I think he would make a very interesting Mr. Norrell.
I think you're right. Except he's a little bit too tall. That's the only thing. He'll have to keep sitting down, and then it might work.
Or do the roll on his knees.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, now, let's move on to the casting of Jonathan Strange. Will he be more Ichabod Crane-ish, more wild and Byron-ish? Byronic, I guess you'd call it?
How well can Johnny Depp do an English accent?
Pretty well, actually, because he did From Hell.
In Pirates of the Caribbean, he sort of affects. So I think that.
Well, I don't know kind of what accent he's doing in the Pirates of the Caribbean.
What would you think of Johnny Depp as Jonathan Strange?
Do you know? I think he's. I love Johnny Depp, and I certainly loved him in Pirates of the Caribbean. Who didn't? But. He's a little bit too good-looking. Strange is not supposed to be quite that
a little quirky.
That's right. Well, one of the characters, Mr. Secundus, was surprised that he wasn't quite that handsome, as I recall.
Yes.
I'm just up to that point in the book. So,
now, as a resident science fiction expert, now that we know that we're grounded here in Dickens and Jane Austen, what science fiction fantasy connections did you notice here? Not that we're trying to make you only derivative, because this is really quite an original undertaking
I'm
here.
I'm very proud of the people, the writers that I've drawn on. I'm very proud of my influences. I'm very happy to talk about them. One of the things, actually, which has been quite interesting when people have finished the book, is they've found all sorts of echoes of other writers, some of whom I've not read and some of whom I haven't even heard of. It's fascinating.
Well, go on with this science fiction connection, the various relatives here found in the book.
One that was mentioned actually in the publicity, but I think is very accurate and that people just never talk about enough, is Mervyn Peake. Who wrote the Gormenghast books. And these are, in a way, also books of manners, as Jane Austen would be. It's not about the fantasy. There's no magic in the Gormenghast books, just weirdness. But it's about these characters and the evocation of these characters and the manners and the way in which they relate, and where they are not necessarily all admirable characters. Mr. Norrell. Is it Norrell or Norrell?
I say Norrell, but Germans and most Americans say Norrell. I don't mind at all.
A German-American.
Well,
then I would probably end up saying Norrell, but Norrell sounds good to me.
Now, Mervyn Peake is a magician's favorite. Mervyn Peake is a literary favorite among magicians. Del Close loved the work of Melvin,
really?
Who Azdak, the combustible, a guy who could eat fire and so forth.
By magicians, you mean prestidigitators.
I guess so, right. Okay. I don't mean really people who affect real change in the universe. I noticed also that you were a cookbook writer.
That's right. Cookbook editor.
Cookbook editor, excuse me. That means that you had extreme patience with the concoction of...
Sometimes I had extreme patience, yes. It's a very painstaking business, editing.
In terms of your reading a great deal of books of magic, was this some sort of assistance to you? Was there any...
The real advantage to me as an editor of nonfiction and for 10 years as an editor of cookbooks was that it put a little distance between me and the writing that I did at home. I think if I'd been a fiction editor, I would have found it much harder to write in the mornings and at weekends, because it would have seemed too much like the day job, I think.
Right.
And the two would have got muddled in my head. But the fact that I was doing something completely different at the day job was a big help to me.
And you were fairly isolated from much of social life during this time. It was a long period of creation here, 10 years.
Yeah, I don't want to give the impression I was a complete recluse. I mean, apart from anything else, I went to an office.
Right.
5 days.
Oh, you did do that.
5 days a week. So I was, I was a cookbook editor at a small office, Simon & Schuster, had in Cambridge. So I had colleagues. But we had to, my partner Colin Greenland and I, we had to make sacrifices for this book. I think somebody once asked Anthony Powell, The Music of Time, is it? His big book. series of books. They said, what sacrifices have you made for your writing? And he said, well, I've had to not go to a party. And I can relate to that. You know, you have to, sometimes your social life is somewhat circumscribed because you're giving so much of your energy to writing.
Right. But nevertheless, the timing of this particular, the moment here for Magic seems to be, have been waiting for you. When we talked earlier about Mervyn Peake, Mervyn Peake is an obscure choice of authors. He never...
In this country,
perhaps. In this country. It's true.
Popular,
he has a huge following. But,
I mean, there's a very popular television miniseries based on the Gorman Gossip books in England.
Okay, but not a household name here. This is going to be quite another story with Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. And, of course, and I mean, and it's the preceding bonanza for Harry Potter. Is there any way you can account for this appetite right now for magic and for spells?
It is certainly fantasy's moment in the sun. That's definitely the case. And it's also, I mean, it's surprising to me because when I started writing this book, I didn't know really there were many other adults who were interested in magicians apart from me. So this has all happened since I've started writing. But I think to people who love stories about magic and fantasy, I think we're at a bit of a loss to explain it because to us it's always been important. And these stories have been going on. Some of the earliest stories were stories of people struggling against supernatural beings. They're stories about magic. So we kind of feel sometimes, well, you know, the earliest story, we kind of invented fiction, you know, the earliest stories were ours. And throughout, I know when I was a child, it was a golden age for fantasy writing for children, and those were the sorts of things. So I'm more at a loss to explain why it went away rather than why it's come back.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it may be something to do with the fact that there are just some excellent fantasy writers around, as well as Rowling, there's Philip Pullman, Neil Gaiman, and then all the children's writers who've come up after J.K. Rowling, like William Nicholson. I mean, there's just some wonderful writers.
Sort of parenthetically and paradoxically also, we were talking about this before we began, actually, in front of the microphone. The most banned book in the United States currently in libraries is Harry Potter. As a sort of paradox to how popular the book is, and the craving and the need for magic and fantasy and wizardry is a sort of shut-up thing, a closed-up, a backlash against the freedom of... How do you account for that? You've just arrived in the United States of Salem, so you may not quite understand what is going on here.
I don't really understand it. I think it's a terrible shame. I have to tell you that I haven't actually read Harry Potter. I've only just begun, because while I was writing, I could tell this was a huge phenomenon and I had to just be careful. I was a bit worried about it influencing me, but I've just started. Mm-hmm. But from everything everybody has told me about it, this is a wonderful story that gets children reading, and I think it's a huge shame to deny them that. And it's a story about good triumphing over evil. What is wrong with that?
I think, if I may hazard a guess, I think that what the Potter books do, and for that matter what Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell does, and all these books of magic and fantasy, is they allow fantasy, they allow freedom, they allow the idea of you can be anything, you can do anything, and frankly, there are a lot of people in the hinterlands in this country who are afraid of freedom. Funny thing for a country that prides itself rhetorically on being based on freedom, and yet I think a great many people shun that and fear it.
Well, we have religious fantasies, one basically, you know, and that's the one that I guess is expected to be adhered to by everyone. So that's just an interesting wrinkle in the popularity of fantasy, is a backlash against it.
I think the very thing that promotes it is also one of the things that makes it that makes people fearful of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The freedom.
Yes.
Well, Jim Freund, before we depart, I'd like you to ask an authentic fantasy question of Susanna Clark.
Oh, geez, with 1 minute left.
So that the cat radio audience, less inclined to letting its imagination wander. We have to deal with more political art most of the time lately.
How was the magic formed? The magic is very unique in Mr. Norrell and Jonathan Strange. And the way what the spells do and the kind of magic they perform, I thought was weird. It gave me that slight little chill, and I've been reading this stuff for years.
I was very much aware at the back of my mind when I started inventing the spells that a writer these days is in competition with video and computer-generated effects where they can do anything. So you've got to add atmosphere, which is harder, I think, for filmmakers and video makers to do. You've got to sort of send a little shiver as well as something spectacular that's visual. And it's also, a lot of it, I think, came out of England itself. I was sort of wanting to convey a lot about England. So some of the magic I've tried to make specifically English in some way or other.
And therein is the answer. Weird, did you say?
Weird.
Okay. Thank you so much, Susanna Clark, for joining us, and Jim Freund for bringing your magical expertise. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is published appropriately by Bloomsbury Books.
Well, that's not the end of the interview. That was the end of what was on Cat Radio Cafe at the time. But we continued with Susanna Clark. We have another, 50 minutes to go. So this is WBAI in New York, and now we continue.
Continuing an interview with the author of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, Susanna Clark. I have usually read through every book before I conduct an interview, and in this case, I got the book a mere 3 weeks.
like the Pulitzer, it's the one which causes the most controversy. The day that I learnt I was on the long list, I was thrilled, and I turned on the radio to listen to the sort of literary arts programme that BBC Radio 4 do in the evening. It's just a short one. And they obviously had an article about the long list, and the first thing that they mentioned was the guys who weren't on it, who were fully expected to be on it. You know, it's a thing which everyone criticises and say, well, it shouldn't be like this, it should be like this. And so it's actually quite a stressful thing. But fortunately, I'm here in America, so I know nothing about it, which is actually quite a relief.
Yeah, all I know is that one day I picked up, we were looking at my PDA together off the air, and I picked up my PDA on which I read Ansible, which is a fanzine put out by...
the date of publication, but there were quite a surprising number of first novels on that long list, and there were a few books that hadn't been published, of which this was one.
I have more questions prepared, but it occurs to me perhaps you would like to read now, or would you?
Sure.
Why don't we do that? Do you care to take a break first, or go right into it?
I will have a short break, just to sip some of my drink, and then I'll go right into it.
We will be back momentarily.
This passage kind of introduces Jonathan Strange. He's a young man, and at this point his father has just died. And this doesn't worry him too much, because quite frankly he and his father didn't get on very well. The chief difference it's made to Strange at this point is that he now thinks that he will go and ask the young woman that he's in love with whether she will marry him, because he reckons that she will never feel more sorry for him than she does at the moment, and he will never be richer. So he and his servant, Jeremy Johns, are travelling, riding through a winter landscape on their way to the village where Strange's beloved, Arabella Woodhope, is staying. 100 yards further on, they entered a village. There was an ancient stone church with winter's golden light upon it, an avenue of ancient twisted hornbeams that led somewhere or other, and 20 or so neat stone cottages with smoke rising up from their chimneys. A stream ran by the side of the road. It was bordered by dry yellow grasses with pendants of ice hanging from them. "Where are all the people?" said Jeremy. "What?" said Strange. He looked around and saw two little girls looking out of a cottage window. "There," he said. "No, sir, those are children. I meant grown-ups. I do not see any." This was true. There were none to be seen. There were some chickens strutting about, a cat sitting on some straw in an ancient cart, and some horses in a field, but no people. Yet as soon as Strange and Jeremy Johns left the village, the reason for this queer state of affairs became apparent. 100 or so yards from the last house, a crowd was gathered round a winter hedge. They carried an assortment of weapons, billhooks, sickles, sticks, and guns. It was a very odd picture, both sinister and a little ridiculous. Anyone would have thought that the village had decided to make war upon the hawthorn bushes and elder trees. The low winter sun shone full upon the villagers, gilding their clothes and weapons and their strange, intent expressions. Long blue shadows streamed behind them. They were completely silent, and whenever one of them... As they rode by, Strange and Jeremy stood up in the stirrups and craned their necks to catch a glimpse of whatever it was that the villagers were looking at. "Well, that is odd," exclaimed Jeremy when they were past. "There was nothing there." "No," said Strange, "there was a man. I am not surprised you could not see him. At first I took him for a hedge root, but it was definitely a man. A grey, gaunt, weather-worn man, but a man remarkably like a hedge root, but a man nevertheless." The road led them into a dark winter wood. Jeremy John's curiosity had been excited, and he wondered who the man could be and what the villagers were intending to do to him. Strange answered once or twice at random, but he soon fell to thinking of Miss Woodhope. "It will be best to avoid discussing the changes brought on by my father's death," he thought. "It is altogether too dangerous. I will begin with light, indifferent subjects. The adventures of this journey, for example. Now, what has happened that will amuse her?" He looked up. Dark, dripping trees surrounded him. There must have been something. He remembered a windmill he had seen near Hereford, with a child's red cloak caught up upon one of the sails. As the sails turned, the cloak was one moment being dragged through the slush and the mud, and the next flying through the air like a vivid scarlet flag. "Like an allegory of something or other. Then I can tell her about the empty village, and the children at the window peeping out between the curtains, one with a doll in her hand and the other with a wooden horse. Next come the silent crowd with their weapons and the man beneath the hedge." "Oh," she was certain to say. "Poor man, what happened to him?" "I do not know," Strange would say. "But surely you stayed to help him," she would say. "No," Strange would say. "Oh," she would say. "Wait," cried Strange, reining in his horse. "This will not do at all. We must go back. I do not feel easy in my mind about the man under the hedge." "Oh," cried Jeremy Johns in relief, "I am very glad to hear you say so, sir. Neither am I." "I don't suppose you thought to bring a set of pistols, did you?" said Strange. "No, sir." "Damn," said Strange, and then flinched a little, because Miss Woodhope did not approve of oaths. "What about a knife, something of that sort?" "No, nothing, sir, but do not fret." Jeremy jumped off his horse and went delving about in the undergrowth. "I can make us some clubs out of these branches, which will do almost as well as pistols." There were some stout branches which someone had cut from a coppice of trees and left lying on the ground. Jeremy picked one up and offered it to Strange. It was scarcely a club, more a branch with twigs growing out of it. "Well," said Strange doubtfully, "I suppose it is better than nothing." Jeremy equipped himself with another branch just the same, and thus armed they rode back to the village and the silent crowd of people. "You there," cried Strange, singling out a man dressed in a shepherd's smock, with a number of knitted shawls tied over it and a wide-brimmed hat upon his head. He made a few flourishing gestures with his club in what he hoped was a threatening manner. "What?" Upon the instant, several of the crowd turned together and put their fingers to their lips. Another man came up to Strange. He was dressed rather more respectably than the first, in a coat of brown cord. He touched his fingers to his hat and said very softly, "Beg pardon, sir, but could you not take the horses further off? They stamp their feet and breathe very loud." "But," began Strange. "Hush, sir," whispered the man. "Your voice, it is too loud. You will wake him up."
"Wake him up? Who?"
"The man under the hedge, sir. He is a magician. Did you never hear that if you wake a magician before his time, you risk bringing his dreams out of his head into the world?
And who knows what horrors he is dreaming of?" agreed another man in a whisper.
"But how..." began Strange. Once again, several people among the crowd turned and frowned indignantly at him and made signs that he was to speak more softly.
"But how do you know he is a magician?" he whispered.
"Oh, he has been in Monk Gretton for the past 2 days, sir. He tells everyone he is a magician. On the first day, he tricked some of our children into stealing pies and beer from their mother's larders.
saying that they were for the Queen of the Fairies. Yesterday, he was found wandering in the grounds of Farwater Hall, which is our great house here, sir. Mrs. Morrow, whose property it is, hired him to tell her fortune. But all he said was that her son, Captain Morrow, has been shot dead by the French. And now, poor lady, she has lain down upon her bed and says she will lie there until she dies. And so, sir, we have had enough of this man. We mean to make him go. And if he will not, we shall send him to the workhouse. Well, that seems most reasonable, whispered Strange. But what I do not understand is... Just at that moment, the man under the hedge opened his eyes. The crowd gave a sort of soft communal gasp, and several people took a step or two backwards. The man extracted himself from the hedge. This was no easy task, because various parts of it, hawthorn twigs, elder branches, strands of ivy, mistletoe and witch's broom, had insinuated themselves among his clothes, limbs and hair during the night, or glued themselves to him with ice. He sat up. He did not seem in the least surprised to find he had an audience. Indeed, one would have so almost supposed from his behaviour that he had been expecting it. He looked at them all and gave several disparaging sniffs and snorts. He ran his fingers through his hair, removing dead leaves, bits of twig, and half a dozen earwigs. I reached out my hand, he muttered, to no one in particular. England's rivers turned and flowed the other way. He loosened his neckcloth, fished out some spiders which had taken up residence inside his shirt, and in doing so he revealed that his neck and throat were ornamented with an odd pattern of blue lines, dots, crosses and circles. Then he wrapped his neckcloth back about his neck, and having thus completed his toilet to his satisfaction, he rose to his feet. "My name is Vinculus," he declared. Considering that he had just spent a night under a hedge, his voice was remarkably loud and clear. For 10 days I have been walking westwards in search of a man who is destined to be a great magician. 10 days ago I was shown a picture of this man, and now by certain mystic signs I see that it is you. Everyone looked around to see who he meant. The man in the shepherd's smock and the knitted shawls came up to Strange and plucked at his coat. "It is you, sir," he said. "Me?" said Strange. Vinculus approached Strange. "Two magicians shall appear in England," he said. "The first shall fear me, the second shall long to behold me. The first shall be governed by thieves and murderers, the second shall conspire at his own destruction. The first shall bury his heart in a dark wood beneath the snow, yet still feel its ache. The second shall see his dearest possession in his enemy's hand." "I see," interrupted Strange. "And which am I, the first or the second? No, do not tell me. It does not matter. Both sound entirely dreadful. For someone who is anxious that I should become a magician, I must say you do not make the life sound very appealing. I hope to be married soon, and a life spent in dark woods surrounded by thieves and murderers would be inconvenient, to say the least. I suggest you choose someone else." "I did not choose you, magician. You were chosen long ago." "Well, whoever it was, they will be disappointed." Vinculus ignored this remark and took a firm grasp of the bridle of Strange's horse as a precaution against his riding off. He then proceeded to recite in its entirety the prophecy which he had already performed for the benefit of Mr. Norrell in the library at Hanover Square. Strange received it with a similar degree of enthusiasm, and when it was done, he leant down from his horse and said, very slowly and distinctly, "I do not know any magic." Vinculus paused. He looked as if he were prepared to concede that this might be a legitimate obstacle to Strange's becoming a great magician. Happily, the solution occurred to him immediately. He stuck his hand into the breast of his coat and pulled out some sheets of paper with bits of straw sticking to them. "Now," he said, looking even more mysterious and impressive than before, "I have here some spells which—" "No, no, I cannot give them to you." Strange had reached out to take them. They are precious objects. I endured years of torment and suffered great ordeals in order to possess them. How much? Said Strange. 7 shillings and 6 pence, said Vinculus. Very well. Surely you do not intend to give him any money, sir, asked Jeremy Johns. If it will stop him talking to me, then yes, certainly. Meanwhile, the crowd was regarding Strange and Jeremy Johns in no very friendly manner. Their appearance had coincided, more or less, with Vinculus's waking, and the villagers were starting to wonder if they might not be two of the apparitions from Vinculus's dreams. The villagers began to accuse one another of having woken Vinculus up. They were just starting to quarrel about it when an official-looking person in an important-looking hat arrived and informed Vinculus that he must go to the workhouse as a pauper. Vinculus retorted that he would do no such thing, as he was not a pauper any more. He had 7 shillings and 6 pence, and he dangled the money in the man's face in a very impertinent fashion. Just as a fight seemed certain to ensue from one cause or another, peace was suddenly restored to the village of Monk Gretton by the simple expedient of Vinculus turning and walking off one way, and Strange and Jeremy Johns riding off another.
And thus, we actually have our second encounter with Jonathan Strange.
Yes, yes. He does appear very, very briefly in an earlier chapter.
Yes, but this is the first one that tells us more about his character.
Yes, that's
right. And so, thank you, by the way, for reading so well. One of the first things that whenever writers come on this program and read, I have to say, no, slower.
All right.
Yeah, many of them speed through, but you have that storytelling technique, more in just the writing, but also in the telling of it. How much, in fact, that brings up a good question. How much, when you are writing, do you hear what you write?
I hear phrases. Yeah. I very rarely hear whole sentences, which is what leads me to write the way I do, which is that I dash down as quickly as I can what I know about a scene, but it tends to be fragments, not even complete sentences, and then I have to work it up from that point.
Yeah, and that can be so difficult. What little writing I do, which is nonfiction, I know that a phrase will appear after staring at a blank page for however long, and then all of a sudden a phrase will appear, and I don't have, by the time I can get it written, it has smoldered and gone somewhere else.
Yes, absolutely.
Enlightened somebody other than me. The marginalia of the book are absolutely wonderful. There are complete short stories in footnotes and such things. Where did this come from?
It's when I first started, when I very, very early on, I wrote down what I knew about this story, and I was writing down 2 lots of material. One was the early medieval stuff, largely about the Raven King. And the other was about the characters who became Strange and Norrell. And at that time, I hadn't quite worked out which story, where the focus was going to be, which story I was going to tell. And when I settled on Strange and Norrell, I had to put in some of the background to the book. Not so much the absolutely essential backstory that you needed to know in order to understand the story, but I wanted to give a taste of what it was, of what they'd lost. Of what the early medieval magic had been like, the sort of glories of it and the weirdness of it. And so most of the footnotes, but not all, concern this world. And I sort of saw them in my mind as brightly coloured little pictures in the margin of an illuminated manuscript. And that was the sort of feel I tried to get.
And obviously it came through, because the word that I thought of in reading those was marginalia.
Yes.
Which is exactly...
Yes, absolutely.
How it worked out. And it's wonderful. you get the impression when you are reading this book, as it makes scholarly references to all these books of magic that obviously everybody who's read this book are already familiar with, because they live in the world where the theoretical magicians have published all their treatises and so forth. It lends so much depth. And clearly, I think by a year from now, we will see people having appropriated, starting to write some of these things.
You reckon?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think there's little question about it. I mean, a year from now, you Google some of these, the titles of, I think we will see many renditions at art shows of The Spirit of Magic urging Mr. Norrell on to...
to the aid of Britannia.
To the aid of Britannia in the Napoleonic Wars and all that. I think that painting, there'll be many versions of that painting.
I shall love to see them if they're all. Well,
hopefully somebody will have the wit to allow you to give the award for one of them. And I think you will see all kinds of things set in your universe. Which brings up the question, do you have more visitations in this universe?
I think I'm having built this world, or having sort of been possessed by this world might be more accurate. I'm not in a great hurry to leave it, so I'm hoping at some point to get back to some writing after this tour is ended, and then I shall be working on a book which finishes a few years after Strange and Norrell. Which starts a few years after Strange and Norrell finishes, but which focuses on different characters. I think some of the old characters will appear, but the focus will be elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. How many years later are we approaching more from Regency to Victoria?
Not many. Or? I'm thinking sort of 5 or 6.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Any short fiction? I mean, there's already a lot of short fiction in the breadth of the novel, as
there,
I said.
There are 7 published short stories.
Within this universe?
No. There are a couple.
I've read 2 of your short stories.
Yeah, the first short story I ever wrote was a Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell story.
What was the title?
That was in Patrick Nielsen Hayden's Starlight One. And it's called The Ladies of Grasse Dieu.
God, I've got that book at home, and
then you have that story.
I even know where that book is.
I should hope you do.
I have a. Like Mr. Norrell, I go out and get every book that I can. Like Mr. Strange, I am not well organized with them. So books often find themselves buried unwillingly.
Yes, I'm a bit the same.
Yeah, but the Starlight books, which I recommend to listeners, are really good anthologies, and original anthologies are rare. Nowadays.
Yes, absolutely. So there's that story, and then there are a couple of stories in Neil Gaiman's worlds, one in his Stardust world and another in his Sandman world.
Okay.
And then the other
one. Where were those published?
The Stardust it's still around. It was in a collection which was done by Charles Vess and Neil when Charles's wife Karen was in an accident. And so various people got together and contributed paintings of the Stardust world. And Neil
Charles Vess, we should tell listeners, is a wonderful artist who does some of the better cover work that you will find.
Yes, and Neil Gaiman's Stardust novel was originally published as 4 shorter books with I think over 100 illustrations.
I hadn't realized
by
that.
Charles Vess. Oh, the paintings are beautiful. I mean, I think the story is wonderful on its own, but
it's
even more wonderful with the pictures.
All I have of that book is an advanced reader's copy, which, you know, I'm proud of having those, but I didn't realize how much I was missing.
No, and I think you can still get it as a it's not really a graphic novel, but it's an illustrated story, and I think it's DC who publish it. So in this package to raise money for Karen, we for her treatment after the accident, we, Neil and I, both did a short story, and it was published in a little portfolio from Green Man Press, Charles Bess's own publishing house. So there's those, and then there are some stories, and I don't really know. I kind of think some of my other fairy stories probably do connect to this world,
mm-hmm.
but I just haven't quite figured out how yet.
Yeah, but that might be retrofitting.
I think it might well be. I'm the sort of writer that likes to make everything connect up at the back if I can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm actually I didn't know about the connection with the Stardust books and your writing. However, in reading this book, I was thinking that it was evocative of specifically the Stardust book. Also, I mean, when I was reading this, my eye happened to glance along my bookshelves where that one is still upstairs instead of in the basement, which is the library, and. And the two books waved at each other. Your book, Neil's book.
Good.
Across the room, they just sort of said hi, and that made a lot of sense to me that they would do that. How for you? This is one of my favorite questions. Are the long form and the short form different? It's a really dumb question, but
no,
I love asking
it's, I think I'm a having written a book that's almost 800 pages long, I think we can say that the long form is more natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
I have written these short stories, but they tend to be on the longer side.
Mm-hmm.
Not all. And they're a bit of a struggle sometimes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I consider some of the marginalia in here to be practically, 500-word short stories.
Yeah. Yes, and if I'm doing little fairy tales, short form seems to come a bit more naturally to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to have that kind of fairy tale structure to it, working things out in threes or something like that. That seems to help me keep it short.
I was going to ask you something, a professional, just something that after all these years of reading that I have noticed with particular writers, perhaps coincidentally mostly British writers, and I've noticed it a little bit with Dickens. It became obvious to me with John le Carré, of all people, and apparent with you, is that very often your voice, the author's voice, is very prominent, particularly in the beginning of each book here, that you are talking to us in the very beginning as we're introduced to Mr. Secundus and his friends, and Mr. Secundus comes back at the beginning of book two as well, and you are there as well. And then the commenting narrator tend to step back a little as we focus in more on Mr. Norrell or our chief characters and the plot at hand. Where does...
I think a lot of that comes from Dickens. I think it's a big Dickensian technique because I think he had such a rapport with his readers. He knew how to talk to them. And he was such a showman as well in later life, doing readings of his own work. So I think that sort of presentation... somehow that kind of blended into his narration skills. So there is a wonderful, strong narrative tone there. But then as the story takes over, it would get too much in the way, so you have to step back. So it's partly from Dickens, but I've also blended in a little of Austen's irony, I hope. Mm-hmm. And also even in C.S. Lewis's Narnia books, there's quite a strong narrative voice there, which I believe he got from E. Nesbitt. Because he wasn't a man who had... When he started writing, I don't think he knew that many children, so he went back to a children's writer he'd loved as a child for his narrative voice.
Yeah. Obviously, I have a lot of rereading to do because while I've read all these books five or more times, I'm realizing some of them I have not read in several years, several being 20, 25 years. So, well, I remember the books and all that. I won't necessarily remember that voice in prose the way you mentioned it, and I will have to reread them with a new eye.
It's finding the time, isn't it?
Oh, it's finding the time and also being very careful what to reread. Because I have also discovered... We talked about Terry Pratchett before, and here's a quote of Pratchett's that I love to invoke. Pratchett said that anybody at age 14 who doesn't think that Tolkien is the greatest writer in the world has something dreadfully wrong with them. Anybody at age 50 who thinks that Tolkien is the greatest writer in the world has something dreadfully wrong with them. And that's a classic Terry Pratchett quote, and very... Some writers don't bear rereading. Now, Tolkien, for me, actually does hold up, although it has a, shall we say, a better perspective in my life than it did in 1972 when I was actually fortunate enough to work with Tolkien. But not face-to-face, but over the phone. Yeah. And many of my favorite writers and their works that spurred me on and helped shape my personality when I was 12, 13 years old, I will pick up and reread again today and with great fondness and go, my God, this is awful.
Yeah. I think, but it doesn't mean to say that the things that you found there when you were young weren't worth finding. It's almost like you can't find them anymore. It's sad in a way.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Sometimes I wonder how much of it is that the world has changed and I have changed. In the case of one particular writer, whose name I shan't invoke right now, it was that the writing just clearly now. It's that the writing wasn't particularly good. There were other wonderful things about the books.
Yeah.
So it's not that they were trash, but they don't hold up. This is a problem that I don't think you will suffer. I think what age do you think people can start? What's the entry level for this book?
This is something I don't know. It was written for adults, and I know that people are now trying it out on their adolescents. And I
think adolescent might be okay.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote Tolkien when I was 11, and I didn't get everything out of it that there was there to be got, but I definitely got a lot. So we'll see. And someone told me recently they were going to try it out on their 10-year-old and their 13-year-old.
Mm, pushing the...
We will see.
13, I think, that's not a problem. 11 is a good age, and perhaps even a sophisticated 10-year-old. And, yeah, they'll be reaching, but there's nothing wrong with reaching.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We have only about 5 minutes left. Because I promised your publicist that we would get you out to bookstores and the rest of your commitments while you're here. What haven't I asked? I'm more of a laid-back conversationalist than an interviewer. What would you like to have been asked by anybody? In this world, you're in the middle of one of these whirlwind deals.
Yeah, I think what's been interesting to me is when I first started being interviewed, people asked me questions. I was really struggling. I kept thinking, well, you know, I just wrote this book. You know, I don't really analyze it. It's been very interesting to me, actually, the process of talking to people about it and being questioned about it has made me realize a lot more of the stuff that went into it that I wasn't aware at the time. And I mean, I think I said earlier that that one of the things that went in there was my love of the English landscape, or that I talked about the magic being very English. But the more I've been forced to focus on how I created this, the more I've realized that a lot of it has come out of a sort of love and a yearning for Northern England, because I kind of feel myself a displaced Northern Englander. I, like many people, I came down south to
to London or to the southern half of England in my adult life because that's where the jobs were.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel this great yearning for the landscapes of northern England. I lived in Yorkshire near the Bronte, the moors and the wild landscapes. And that was one of the things that I wanted to get into this book. And I think you'll find, as you read on a bit further, that that becomes more and more a concrete part of English magic.
Mm. Well, I don't have a good closing other than to recommend to everybody on your first hearing this broadcast, read the book, and in the rebroadcast 5 years from now, to reread it. And this is a book that I think will well. I haven't finished it, and I'm ready to reread it.
Okay, and let me say that having said that, it's now 10 years later. It's now 10 years after that. And now you can reread the book or read it for the first time. And if you like, watch the TV series. Episode 1 is available for free on YouTube. Otherwise, you have to find a way to watch BBC America or the BBC itself or some other way. But I am enjoying the hell out of it. It's a very well done adaptation, obviously not with Tony Head. It stars Eddie Marson and Bertie Carvel, but it is brilliant as the book, but different from the book. Read Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke. Watch the miniseries version, and I will be back next week. And with any luck, maybe we'll stay on the air this time. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming over these airwaves if the crick don't rise. Have a wonderful week and stay tuned.
Walking along, what is it makes her to rebound? myself with the last words on my lips. I am.
Myself, torture the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control. So they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the peace work. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs dribble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that beast to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Just a mother. You gave me freedom of speech in the first. First Amendment. So why the wanna scold me? When I touch the flag, I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Me limpió la vida del peso de mis errores. Ahora